It's nice to see everyone as usual. There were two explorers in an African jungle that were suddenly startled by a stalking lion at close range. One quietly said to the other, "Shh, be careful, don't move. Remember the survival book we were given? I read that last night, and it says that when a lion stalks you, you just be still and look at it straight in the eye, and then it slinks off." The other explorer said, "Yes, I read the same book, but that doesn't satisfy me." "How come?" said the first. "Well, I'm not sure that the lion read the book. I don't know if he knows what he's supposed to do." Wild beasts such as lions or even bear can present perplexing challenges to us. And such was the case for a young shepherd boy by the name of David that long ago was shepherding and herding sheep and was challenged by an angry lion. And according to what he said later, he was able at that young age, as a teenager, to grab that lion by the hair, by the mane, and twist it and break its neck. Not there long thereafter, he did the same thing with a bear, was able to kill it. And that's quite an accomplishment at any age. I understand that he had incredible reflexes, but over and beyond that, you have to imagine that, believe that God was behind him. God had intended for him to be the king over Israel. He was not going to allow a wild beast to kill him. Perhaps God was impressed with his passion for his sheep. One of the most remarkable things about David's accomplishments in that way, and we'll read that over in 1 Samuel 17, you could turn over there if you will, is that in these major confrontations that he had at an early age, he exhibited no fear. Now, he might have had anxiety, but he showed no fear, not outwardly. Most of the time, David was able to slay his giants, his enemies. But in 1 Samuel 17, David was faced with a challenge much bigger than that of a lion or a bear. He was confronted with the giant Goliath, who was an experienced warrior who anxiously wanted to kill David. In 1 Samuel 17 is where that account is mentioned, and 1 Samuel 17 is the basis for what I'd like to cover today. Because even though David killed his Goliath, his giant, you and I must learn how God's servants killed their giants so that we can kill ours. You and I also have giants in our lives, and I think we need to consider what it does take to kill a beast, an adversarial beast, a giant, such as what we'll see in the story that unfolds. I'd like for us now to go to verse 1 of 1 Samuel 17. Here we can read, "Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled in Judah. They pitched camps in Ephes-Damon between Succoth and Azekah. And Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley in between." I'm reading from a current translation here. "And a champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits in the span. He had bronze helmet on his head. He wore a coat of scale armor, bronze, weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs he wore other metal. A bronze javelin was slung on his back. A spear shaft was like a weaver's pod." And we can go on and on, speaking in language that is perhaps a bit archaic for our time today. But in retrospect, the dimensions that are referred to in verse 4 are, would be as if he were over 9.5 feet tall. That would be Goliath was over 2 feet taller than, say, Shaq O'Neal. He weighed 350 to 400 pounds. His bronze javelin was at least 20 pounds in weight. That's an enormous amount of weight to carry. And the mail, the coat of armor on him, was between 125 and 150 pounds. So he was incredibly massive muscle. He was strong. He was intimidating. He was a warrior from his youth. He probably intimidated tens of thousands of people in his career as a fighter in the front lines of the Philistine army. enough to certainly scare and hold the Israelites at bay. And one of the customs of the particular time that we're reading about was that many battles were determined by having one representative from a particular army duel it out with a representative of another army. In fact, you can read in 2 Samuel where Judah and Israel attempted to settle a score by sending fighters, representatives out from each side. But here, the challenge was laid down by Goliath that if he were to be defeated by a representative of the Israelite army, then the Philistines would be their servants. But of course, if he were able to slay whoever the Israelites or King Saul would put forth, then of course the Israelites would become the slaves. And they were very close to that anyway. The Philistine army had made major inroads into Israel. They had dominated the Israelites. Just the opposite of what God had wanted. But of course, Israel, to take a reference back to this wonderful message we heard already today, didn't have their moral compass, and they were totally at sea, totally lost. And here we see the aftermath of that, that they were living in abject fear. Wasn't it Joshua that was told by Moses, be strong and of good courage and go out into the land of Canaan and to subdue it and conquer it? And after a number of years, here are the Israelites quaking in their boots, shivering behind the trees on their side of the valley, scared out of their minds of this giant Goliath. Verse 8. Goliath stood and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, why do you come and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. And if he's able to fight and kill me, we'll become your subjects. And if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us. And the Philistine said, this day I defy the armies of the God of Israel. And of Israel, give me a man that let us fight each other. On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and they were terrified. Now, David, the son of an Ephraimite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was very old. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to the war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second was Abinadab, and the third was Shammah. And David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul and tended his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand, shouting at the top of his lungs, you cowards, you have no one to represent yourself. Who will fight me? Who will take me on? It would go on 80 times. The Israelites listened to this babble. Now Jesse said to his son David, verse 17, take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are coming and bring back some assurance from them. There with Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines. Well, that was his perception. They were shaking. They were scared. They were intimidated. They were worried. Early in the morning, David left the flock in the care of a shepherd, loaded up, and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines, facing each other. Same verse, second verse, same as the first, or 40th verse, same as the first. David left his things with the keeper of the supplies and ran to the battle lines. And he asked how the brothers, how they were. And as he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance. And David heard it. And whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled in great fear. So much for holding their positions. And so the same taunting, who will fight me? You cowards of Israel, your God is impotent. You have no hope. Now the Israelites had been saying, verse 25, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family line from taxes in Israel. And David asked those standing near him, what will be done for the man that kills this Philistine, removes this disgrace from Israel? And as he boldly said, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Boy, David was of a different mindset. He was fearless. He'd killed his bear, he'd killed his lion, and he had a relationship with God, and he was indignant. That relationship inspired him to think, this is absolutely wrong. How can that guy get away with that? Why are we sitting here quivering? Isn't there a God, our God, that is capable of enabling us to overcome this giant? So they kept repeating to him over the time. They had nothing else to do. This is what will be done for the man who kills him. When Eliab, David's older brother, heard him speaking with the men, he was burned with anger. And he said to him, why have you come down here? You just came down here to see the battle, didn't you? And you're leaving those sheep behind. Who are they with now? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You just came down to watch the battle. Maybe he was conceited. Sometimes people accuse others of their own problems. At any rate, David felt he was totally innocent. He says, what have I done? Verse 29. Can't I even speak? Then he turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter. He was really moved on this. And as he did, he didn't realize that he was exuding a confidence that was in total contrast to the climate of the other people in the army. So much so that the word got back to Saul. Hey, we got a tiger in the camp here. He's a little guy, but boy, he's fearless. He's talking stuff that, well, I don't know what to think. He says that this Goliath is defying the great God of Israel. And he wants to do something about it. And whether or not they agreed, that became the talk of the army. The word got around because after 40 days of quivering, you know, what else are you going to talk about? You've thought about everything else. And so this ray of light comes into the camp and it makes an impression. So as it turns out, Saul sent for him. In verse 32, David takes the initiative here. He initiates everything. He walks up to the king. He's not intimidated. Of course, he had played music for him months before, but Saul didn't recognize him. And here he is at age 16, 17, somewhere along in there. He talks to the king very confidently. Let no one lose heart on the account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. Whoa! Nobody's ever offered. And who? This guy? He's willing to do it? Saul replied, you're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. Why, you're a little more than a boy, and he has been a warrior from his youth. Now, this was after the 40th day. Had this been day one or two, Saul and his army probably would have said, get this guy out of here. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's too little. He has no experience. He's a youth. You can't expect too much from a youth, can you? So they didn't want anything to do with it, probably wouldn't have. But after 40 days, when you know that there are no other answers, and you're shivering and you're cowarding because that giant like a roaring lion is stalking you and your army, and you think that the end might be near, and your fearless king is fearful, King Saul, who is head and shoulders above everybody else, over 7 feet high, and he doesn't have any answers, and he's a bit nervous and worried. Let no one lose heart on the account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. Boy, that echoed. Saul was amazed. Verse 34, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after and struck it. And I rescued the sheep from its mouth. And when it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both a lion and a bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be as one of them, because he's defied the armies of the great God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine. That was supreme confidence. And to me, I still find it shocking, though, that King Saul, who towered probably a couple feet above David, okay, go and the Lord be with you. Here he's putting the future of and the fate of all of Israel in the hands of a youth. He's never seen him in action, but he sure talks a good talk. He sure exudes confidence. It just shows you how abjectly miserable and in great fear everybody was. They thought they would die. They thought it was about over. It was like, what else can we do? We have no other recourse. We would have thought about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, 40 days ago. We're out of ideas. It's the 11th hour, and it looks grim. So, if we go down, we'll go down in flames. We'll hitch our wagon to this little kid, and he's going to go out there, and I guess he's going to do it. Couldn't believe it. But how can you go the way you're going? Sometimes we may face giants, and we might feel the same way. I don't know how I'll get past this. I don't know how I can conquer this, but I don't have any other ideas and no other recourse, and I need help. Well, Israel needed lots of help. They needed somebody to turn the tables to defy this giant. And so Saul did the human thing. You know, there is a way that seemeth right. He dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and bronze helmet on his head. I'm sure that bronze was dragging the ground. David fastened his sword over the tunic and tried walking around, but he was not used to all of this. He says, I can't go in these, he said to Saul, because I'm not used to them. So he took them off. And I imagine that the seasoned warriors, the grizzled veterans of Israel, that was standing around with their rapt attention, their jaws dropped when he says, look, I'm taking this stuff off. And then he chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in a pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with no armor, he grabbed the sling in his hand and he approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He couldn't believe it. He looked David over and he saw that he was little more than a boy. Ah, what insult. What are they trying to pull here? Glowing with health, yes, and handsome, but Goliath despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? What is this, a joke? I expect a warrior, not some little punk kid with a handful of stones, no armor. This is a joke. But I guess this is all you can put up. You guys are worse off than I thought. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he says, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. And David said to the Philistine, notice how much he invokes the name of God in this. He doesn't think that he's out here on his own. He thinks that he is God's representative. He thinks and believes, he actually dares to think that God is backing him up. And David said to this Philistine, and I hope that it was echoing loudly enough that the other army men could hear it. You come to me against me with sword and a spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day will the Lord, notice he didn't say I, this day will the Lord deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. Fearless. Like a banty chicken, holding his ground against a roaring lion. I'll cut off your head. This day will I give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals and to the whole world, that it will know that there is a God in Israel. All those that are gathered here will know that it is not by the sword and the spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. Boy, is that ever brazen. Now he's defying the entire Philistine army. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, thinking, I've heard enough. I've heard enough drivel out of that little kid. I'm going to run him through with my lance like I've run so many thousands of others. He's mincemeat, dead meat. Now notice, as the Philistine moved closer, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him, charging, reaching into his bag and taking out a stone. I don't know if you know much about slings, but they can be powerful. They can hurl a stone up to 200 miles an hour. And if you're as close as, say, a baseball hitter is to a pitching mound, 60 feet, you've got a third of a second or less at that kind of speed to be able to duck or move. But what are the odds of being so accurate with this, against a Philistine who's armored, his chins, his legs, his arms, his head? Reaching to the bag, he took out a stone and slung it and struck the Israel on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead. Of course it did. It was so fast. And he stood there for a second, and then he collapsed. His knees buckled. He collapsed, and he fell face down on the ground. Perhaps he was dead before he hit the ground. But whether or not he was at least motionless. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, without a sword in his hand, and he struck the Philistine and killed him. Ran over to him, took a hold of the Philistine's sword, lifted it up, all 20 pounds of it, and sliced off his head. Boy, was that ever a sight. Did the Israelites and the Philistines do a double take when they saw that? When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and they ran. And the men of Israel and Judah surged forth with a shout and pursued the Philistines all the way down to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron. And their dead were strewn along the road from Gath and Ekron. And there was great plundering. David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem. And very innocently he put the Philistine's weapon in his own tent. And everybody was wondering, who is this guy? What happened? How can this be? It was amazing. I think that when the alarm sounded to charge after the Philistines, there was probably a couple of seconds for people to think, "What do I? Can I believe what I just saw? I guess we're the winners. Charge! Go get them!" You know. It was quite a testimony, a zealous testimony to the power of God and great confidence in a time of deep consternation and anguish and turmoil. That's what it took to kill Goliath, an adversarial beast. Do you have giants to face yourselves? Giants larger than a lion or a bear? Perhaps the need for a better job, better employment, or how about a place to live? Many people have giants. It could be argued that all of us have giants, maybe more than one. I was talking to a dear friend recently, lives in Colorado. He's homeless, has been for some time, living out of a car, and it snowed a couple of feet of snow a couple of days ago. What'll happen to him? That's his giant. What'll happen to people that live in expensive areas of the United States or Europe that lose their jobs? I happen to have an experience recently talking to several brethren, hardworking executives in the Silicon Valley near San Francisco. And such pressure that people are under to make the ends meet. And some people have very responsible jobs in some of these areas, and yet they don't know if they're training the replacement. They don't know if there'll be another job merger, and in spite of an outstanding work record, they'll be let go. And maybe they're in middle management, and the company is downsizing. Met a number of people, even in this area, one a couple days ago here. Had 83 employees, now has 15. So what kind of morale do these people have? And then a few days ago on a travel, I was talking to somebody who was just coming from California, and we were talking about the job situation. And I said, I realize that there's a lot of pressure for these people. In fact, I met two that were working 80 hours a week. As soon as Saturday Sabbath was over, they were off to work on salary, not an hourly wage, in order to take care of things and to keep their businesses that they are connected with moving along. And she says, I know, I just got laid off. I know what that's all about. And I felt, my heart went out to her. So there are different giants that we face. So a story that we have read that's not just a story but is actual fact is no longer just an academic experience or some nice story for children. It is very real and it plays out in our lives constantly. And we will need to slay giants in the future. There are giants that overwhelm some of us. Giants such as loneliness, insecurity, perhaps a hidden addiction, alcoholism, pornography, drug abuse, eating. It can be any number of manifestations. The fear of people. The fear of not being able to make the ends meet in this economy. The fear of your health condition. The fear of failure. Or do you realize that there exists such a thing as the fear of success? There are some people that as soon as they get close to being successful, they panic and they think, I'm going to sabotage this. They think that subconsciously. There are any number of things that people wrestle with that maybe they're afraid to talk about. But things that may burden them down, skeletons, unresolved issues, anxieties and fears. Not that life is consistently that way. But there are sometimes major giants that not just David, not just King Saul, but with all of us together that we may face collectively and individually. Goliath was over 9.5 feet tall. He had a collar size of about 20 inches. He was fully armored, covered with metal. But David prevailed. Even King Saul, a warrior who had led Israel into battle, who had been involved with the destruction of 40,000 Philistines in the past, he clearly was afraid. And yet David had no fear. He charged against his adversary. We have to charge against our giants. It's interesting that he took 5 smooth stones in a sling. Some people will say, well, he took those 5 stones because he knew he could have missed Goliath. And then he would need to reload. But just like 2 men in the old Wild West that would be pulling pistols or guns at each other, how much time against a seasoned veteran like Goliath would you have to reload and go pull another stone out of your purse and rev up that stone with a sling before you let it go? You'd be history before you'd have a second chance. Goliath was no slouch. He knew how to kill. David had only 1 shot at it, a split second basically, and he succeeded and he took down Goliath. So what would the other 4 stones be for? Well, we don't know exactly, we can't guarantee it, but Goliath had 4 brothers. And it's chosen later on in the book of Samuel that David and his men had to deal with all 4 of those brothers. So the point being that even if you slay a giant, there could be another or another or another. But David was deadly accurate, and I think that we can give God credit for that. But the amazing thing, more than the fact that Goliath collapsed and was killed, was the fact that David had no fear. Some important scriptures come to mind here. One is Zechariah 4, verse 6. Zechariah 4, verse 6, and let me quote that. It says, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, that not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. And I think we understand that in the end time, trying to do an end time work, that over and above our best efforts, it really takes God to magnify our results. I've used examples in the past. The Reader's Digest ad that never got run in Great Britain. And we couldn't afford to cover but a small section of the country. And after an apology from Reader's Digest, they said, we'll run the whole thing over next week because of our month, because of our oversight. And for the same money, we'll blanket the whole country. God can multiply our money. He can multiply our efforts. He can magnify if our hearts are right and if we are believing. It says in Luke 1, verse 37, with God, all things are possible. Luke 1:37. And many times things are repeated for emphasis. So you can turn over to Matthew 19 and verse 26 and read the same statement. With God, all things are possible. I imagine that if we were to go back as CNN near Fox News, back to the valley in which Goliath was killed, we could have interviewed various people. And I think the perspectives of the different individuals that witness Goliath's death would be quite interesting. First of all, if we could interview General Abner, who is under King Saul, says, "Mr. Abner, what was it like? Describe that defining moment when the giant went down." He would have perhaps said, "I couldn't believe it. Such a mismatch. This little kid attacking a polar bear with a toothpick. That's about the way I describe it. That kid couldn't wear Saul's armor. He wasn't very tall and he had no experience in warfare. He should have been turned into mincemeat." I didn't say anything because my job is to obey orders. But I thought, oh king, this is a terrible mistake. We've been holding our ground for 40 days and now we're putting the hands of the country into this unknown quantity, this kid. I thought it was a real mistake sending the kid out to do a job that was impossible for a man. I just knew that the Philistines would rally from henceforth and kill us all. But when it happened, when Goliath stumbled and he fell down, I was flabbergasted. I was stunned. I was so stunned, I was a minute slow in giving the Israelites the command to charge and get the Philistines on the run. Now, if we were to interview Eliab, he would have said, the oldest brother, "I can't believe what I just saw. I can't believe it. My kid brother did that? That guy should be back with the sheep. Why, he has no business being out here. I told him that. I've told him that every time he has come. He could have had us all killed." But Eliab, weren't you there when the prophet Samuel anointed your brother to be king over all of Israel? Didn't you think that maybe God had a great future for him? Oh, no, don't even go there with that question. I don't even know what to think about it because I don't understand it yet. As far as I'm concerned, I'll be the one that has to tell Dad that the sheep were neglected. He understood it later because he and at least several of his brothers joined up with David. But it's just like with Christ's brothers and sisters. It was difficult probably for them to find out how much their brother knew, how special he was, and that he was divine as well as human. You know, the learning curve sometimes takes a while when we're so close to the tree we can't see the forest. Now, the interview with Goliath's brother probably went something like this. One of the brothers: "You know, I was near the front lines for many days, but on that particular day, I was in the back of the army with other responsibilities. Or I might have tried to take matters into my own hands. But remember my words. David is a marked man. He killed my brother Goliath, and I plan to kill him. He will pay for my brother's death." As I mentioned, Goliath had four brothers, 2 Samuel 21 and verse 22. And there was a future combat between those brothers and David and his men, according to that particular verse. What I want to point out here is that life didn't get any easier for David, because Goliath's brothers would be gunning for him. In other words, that when we slay a giant, sometimes there's another giant. Wasn't that the case with Elijah? He called down fire from heaven at Mount Carmel and killed 450 prophets of Baal. And you'd think, okay, well now there's closure there. But no, there was another giant after that. It was Jezebel who said, "I'm going to put Elijah to death. I'm going to turn loose at my disposal all my resources, all the army, everybody to track this guy down and punish him." And Elijah was intimidated by that and had to reevaluate his spiritual state in order to recover and to not be so fearful. What is your giant? And again, you may have more than one. Could it be a bully at school? Could it be an adversarial boss? A fear of something? The proactive question is to ask, where do I go from here? The retroactive wrong thing to say is, I'm scared. I'm frozen in fear. I just won't do anything. I'll pretend that it's not there. I'll pretend that there's no elephant in the living room. Or I'll just ignore it. No, David, in his confrontation, he ran toward Goliath. Now, that's, you know, the Bible is tough on its heroes, and it calls it the way it is. And there are some other things that I want to point out here, because it has we have the potential to be successful or not be successful in our spiritual lives. And I think we know that we want the former and not the latter. The sad thing about David's dealings with his next Goliath, and there was more than one, is that unlike in 1 Samuel 17, when he charged toward the enemy, he ran away from the enemy. I'm not here to look down on him and say, how could he have done that? Without being close to God, any of us are capable of doing the wrong thing. Inadvertently, David allowed the trials that ensued with King Saul to wear him down. If we go to 1 Samuel 18, we've seen initially in the first few verses that Saul is enamored with David. He's thrilled that David is an asset to him and to all of Israel. And whatever, verse 5, whatever mission Saul sent David on, he was so successful. And Saul gave him a high rank in the army, which pleased the troops and Saul's officers as well. And when the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out of all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing and joyful songs and with timbrels and musical instruments, and they danced, they sang. Saul, they said, has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands, and repeated that over and over. Saul was very angry with that. He probably looked at Abner. What are they saying? Are my ears hearing it right? Sir, they're saying that you've killed your thousands, but what else are they saying? David has killed his tens of thousands. Oh, he thought, but with me only thousands, what more can he get but the kingdom? And from that time on, verse 9, Saul kept a close eye on David. You can't trust that guy. You just can't trust him. When the opposite was the case. By the end of verse 10, he resolved to pin David to the wall with his spear. He would pretend that he was listening to the music that David would be playing, and then in an unguarded moment, grab his spear and try to kill him. And that happened twice. And of course, that was very, very unsettling. He went ahead and gave his daughter, Michal, to David to marry. But he, from then on, plotted time and time again to put him to death. I'm going to summarize in chapter 20, 21, 22. David fled from Saul and ran to Nob, where he was trying to get help from the high priest. And then Saul sent his henchmen, Doeg, and others up there and killed the high priest and a total of 85 priests. They would spare no expense. They knew no shame, no limitation to go out and kill David. So it wouldn't be easy for any of us if we were in his shoes. But at this point, he decided that the best thing he could do was to flee to the Philistines, the people that he was the arch enemy of. And so in 1 Samuel 21, I'm sorry, not the 21. Yeah, 21 verse 10. That day David finally fled from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. That's right in the heart of the Philistia country. But the servants of Achish said, hey, he's telling the king, isn't this David, the king of the land? Isn't he the one they sing about in their dances, that Saul's killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands? He's a political prisoner. Let's take him. Let's deal with him. We have a score to settle with him. And David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. This is the person who was so fearless, not afraid of a lion or a bear, certainly not afraid of Goliath, but he's afraid of the king of Gath. This can happen when you drift away from God and you have no relationship or a limited relationship. The closer one is to God, the more fearless one can be. But if somebody is fearful of everything, just like King Saul was fearful and others, then even a small challenge can be so daunting and intimidating. And so now he was afraid of Achish. And I'm sure Achish was not as intimidating as Goliath was. So he pretended to be insane in their presence. While he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the door of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard, rolling around trying to look like a monkey or some other animal and be confused in appearance. Achish said to his servants, "Look at this man. He's insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madman that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house?" Perhaps he decided that this couldn't possibly be David. So this is what David was resorting to. He didn't do that to Goliath. He didn't say, "Uh-oh, I'm afraid now. I'm going to put down my 5 stones and I'm going to act like a madman. I'm going to drool. I'm going to roll around the dirt. I'm going to grovel and change Goliath's mind to not kill me." What a change. But David was human. And human beings, if they're not close to God, are capable of doing foolish things. And you can check the rest of the next chapters, chapter 24 and chapter 26, where you have to imagine that David really made some kind of a spiritual rebound, because several times he had the opportunity to turn the tables on King Saul and put Saul to death. Saul, with a 3,000-man crack army, was chasing him all over the wilderness of Judea. And David twice had the chance to kill King Saul, and he would not do it, and he proved that. But in spite of that, he decided, "I don't see any closure on these trials." He wasn't thinking, "God will take care of me. He said I will be king over Israel." Day after day, he was on the run. And sometimes when we're busy and engulfed in our problems, or just the routine of life, we can be so busy, busy, busy that we may not have much of time for God, or think that we do, in which case we pay a price for that. Sometimes it's better to say, "I have so much to do, I have to get away and pray. I have to study." If you pray, say, 10 minutes a day or whatever, unless you're just starting out brand new, it's not going to cut it. You're not going to slay any giant doing that. If you blow the dust off your Bible maybe once a week and say, "Well, I guess I'll make a little time for God," you're not going to move any mountains. You're not going to get anywhere. But if you have a strong, abiding relationship and you have regular contact, all the world can change in front of you. Those giants can shrink and disappear. So David paid a price, and in chapter 27, he ran back to the Philistines. He decided he was safer there than he was with King Saul. And in God's mercy, God directed events so that King David would not have to fight his fellow countrymen when the Philistines attacked and actually put Saul and his son Jonathan to death. So David was not, if you charted his spiritual progress, it was up and down. As a teenager, it was phenomenal. I can remember on one visit, I was talking to a woman this far away from here, a wonderful family, but they had this one 19-year-old, and he was, as so often some are prone to do, locked up in his room, riveted on a computer game. I will say this, I think it's wonderful that youth can develop computer skill. I wish I knew half of what they knew. But there's something wrong when people get so disconnected with the real world and they're unable to communicate with people and they're just gravitated on these games all the time. And that was him. And his mom said kind of apologetically after he walked in, I says, "Hi, how are you doing?" "Huh?" And they walked away. She says, "Well, you can't expect too much from a 19-year-old. I thought, "Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Have you read 1 Samuel 17? I could expect a whole lot more from this, quote, kid in chapter 17 than I could young adult in chapter 27 of 1 Samuel 27. For him, because the relationship with God made the difference. You know, we have young people that could be maybe the next King Josiah, who at age 7, age 8, had a sense of right and wrong, made a difference for other people? The relationship with God knows no bounds. It's not only the property of those that are older, but of people of any age. And David started off on a wonderful foundation. And he spent a lot of retrospective time in writing the Psalms and then thinking of ways to get back to that. And by the time that he conquered the land around him, united Israel, and then was able to dedicate a worship place for God and to gather the materials and to bring the Ark of the Covenant, he was on a spiritual high in his most famous dance. That was a little wild maybe, but he was excited for the Lord. And in spite of whatever mistakes he made and shortcomings which we all have made, God said, Acts 13:22, he's a man after my heart. I remember his zeal. I remember what he did with Goliath and other things. Yes, he had his dips, he had his valleys, but he always rebounded. And there's a statement over in Proverbs 24 and verse 26. Let me go there. Proverbs 24. Where is this? I've got a different book, and so it's not, the verse is not located in the upper right-hand corner, you know, 3 inches down off of. Verse 16. For though the righteous fall 7 times, Hebrew expression means many times, they rise again. They rise again, but the wicked stumble when calamity strikes. Proverbs 24:16. The righteous could fall multiple times, but get up. That's as important as the actual accomplishment. God wants to see that. He knows we're not perfect. He knows we're dust. David was the one that wrote that, Psalm 103. He talks about the fact that he had to have sins removed. He knew that he was but a vapor. And he knew that God understood that. And that gave him confidence that he knew that there was a hand to hold him when he would reach out, even if he stumbled, even if he ran to the Philistines or committed the other mistakes that he made in his life, numbering Israel, for example. And then there are extrapolate from this, that among the giants that are out there, some may be external forces that come against us, perhaps future persecution for the church. And then there are some giants that are Frankenstein monsters that we may make ourselves. David is an example again of this with Bathsheba and Uriah. But as bad as that was, he rebounded. And God remembers, first and foremost, he is a man after my heart, and inspired that to be recorded of him hundreds of years after he died. Another amazing example, I think, that we can look at is over in Joshua chapter 10. Joshua 10, when the Israelites were conquering the land of Canaan. In Joshua 10, in verse 7, Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men. That was a considerable distance in order to join up with the Gibeonites because they were under a massive attack. 5 kings, the 5 different nations, united their armies in order to obliterate Joshua. They thought it was now or never, that they had to do that in order to protect their turf. And so verse 8, and the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid of them, for I have given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you. Now there are times when people will rely on God and they might think, well, I just like to rely and trust in God. He's just going to do it all for me. Not understanding that one of the principles in a partnership relationship that we have with God is that there should be trust, yes, faith in God, but a willingness on our part to do whatever it is that we can do. So as James points out, it's faith and works. They go together, faith and works. If you have faith, in God to do something, you're relying on Him, but you don't do what you can do for yourself, you may not get very far. And the balance to that is, if you do everything on your own as if God didn't exist and you don't pray to God and ask for His involvement in a spiritual battle, you may not get anywhere either. So it's faith and works. James 2:14 and 19 and 20 illustrate that. Now we see in chapter 10 of Joshua that after an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise. Now, God could have, I guess, put them in chariots and like He did Elijah and just transported them right over to the battle front. But they had to march all night. It's as if it all depended on them. Then the Lord threw the adversaries into confusion before the Lord so that Joshua and the Israelites defeated them completely at Gibeon. And Israel pursued them along the road going up to Beth Horon and cut them off all the way down to Azekah and Makkedah. Interesting, that's the same region that Goliath faced David. As they fled before Israel on the road down from Beth Horon, the Lord hurled large hailstones down on them, and more of them died of the hail than that which was killed by the swords of the Israelites. And the Lord, on the day that the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "Sun, stand over Gibeon, and you, moon, over the valley of Ajalon." And the sun stood still, the moon stopped, till the nation avenged itself of its enemies, as is written in the book of Jashar. Now, we don't, unless we have some future archaeological dig that we'll find it, we've never, ever had the privilege of locating a book of Jashar to get independent corroboration of this event. But what is implied here is that at the suggestion of Joshua, who was saying, you know, God, hold up the, bring time to standstill so we'll have sufficient opportunity to slay the adversaries, that God was able to miraculously freeze the sun in an orbit somehow, or change the light rays, or I don't know what, but create a miracle by which the daylight hours would extend and extend until Israel finished the battle. So even though the Israelites had to work all night and they had to fight and do everything that they could, it was God that really provided the victory. He made the day long, and I glossed over purposely, but I want to go back to verse 11, that hailstones were involved, and more died of the hail than were that died by the swords of the Israelites. God's part was bigger than the Israelites' part. But Israel still had to work hard as if it all depended on them. Let's consider also the case in Daniel 3 of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Can you expect a whole lot from young people? Those three men were young in the nation of Babylon, and they were riveted in their commitment to God. And it was incredible how they were willing to walk into a fiery furnace rather than to cave in as everybody else did to Nebuchadnezzar's demand to worship this foolish idol. And that was quite an inspiration. And there are modern day examples. I remember an ambassador student who ran out of money in Pasadena. She had just gotten there, took a bus, very frugal, trying to scrimp and save, and somehow there was misinformation, and she realized she needed much, much more money than what she was led to believe earlier. And she had worked. She'd done everything that she could do. And here she called her mom. She says, "Looks like I'm going to come home." And it was a major effort for the family to get her out there. She said, "I don't know what's going to happen. I don't have the money, and I need, in today's equivalency, about $4,000. And Mom, she and prayed, and her mom prayed, and they fasted about it. There was no dad in the picture. There were no other relatives that could help. And an individual showed up at the bursar's office that nobody had ever seen before or since. And in a matter of a few seconds, dropped an envelope, says, "This money is for so-and-so, for college." Turned around, walked out before anybody could ask anything. And it was the exact amount of money that she needed to be able to stay there, take care of her lodging, and to take care of the tuition and food. And I know of a pastor who had the same experience 40 years ago when he was at the college. There's a woman I met one time that was able to get a very important job that covered expenses in a very expensive area to live. And it was a case where she could not leave that area. And the company insisted that everybody had to work some Saturdays per month. Anybody that would get Saturday off would certainly and clearly arouse the jealousy of the other coworkers. And it looked like an impossible situation for her that she was going, and she was told that she would be fired for nonconformity. A giant of a problem. And it so happened because of some smaller medical condition, a medical person overrode the objections of everybody in the administration and everybody else in the office and said, for reasons of health, she has to have a couple days off in a row, and one of them has to be Saturday. So it wasn't over religion. But you know, for people that are imperfect like all of us, it's encouraging to know that God didn't wait till we had it, quote, all together before He would bless us or demand that we be perfect right now. He says, strive for it, Matthew 5:48. But He knows our frame. He knows we're dust. He realizes that sometimes we stumble. It's great when He intervenes for us. In the autobiography, I think of the example of Mike Helms, one of the earliest church members to be called into the work that Mr. Armstrong was beginning in Oregon. He was a farmer, and he faced a great disaster, a giant of a problem, in the depths of the Great Depression because a massive flood came through the Willamette Valley and wiped out all the crops. He had just a few on higher ground that had survived, but that was not enough. Mr. Armstrong felt bad for him and tried to console him, and he said, you know, I'm just not worried. How can that be? He says, well, it says in Romans 8:28, all things work out for good, and I can't see how a disaster like this can work out for good, but I just know it will. So I'll do my part, and my God is, if He can help Goliath's demise and intervene for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I'm sure He can take care of me. And as it was, he went back when the floods abated. He was able to replant part of the land. And as it turned out, he was the only farm in that whole region that harvested anything. So the crop that he had, he was able to sell for many times more than otherwise would be selling for. So he actually came out making much more money than he would have otherwise. And he was beginning to tithe, and he was thrilled to see God's hand in the picture. There are any number of interventions. There was a case of Mr. Armstrong acquiring the Hewlett Mansion next to Ambassador College. In 1947, it was worth arguably hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe $1 million. Mr. Armstrong, after prayer, picked that property up for $11,000 at public auction. How come? There were no other bidders. But God couldn't do anything like that now, could He? No. The statute of limitations has probably run out on His powers. He's probably thinking, oh, those people down there in Florida, I'd really like to help them. You know, I see different needs. They've got these giants, but hey, these are rough times. I can't do the things I used to do. I don't even think I'm strong enough to create an asteroid, let alone a little bug or a mosquito. You know, I sure hope those federal bailouts help those people down there on planet Earth, because I'm getting old. I've lost my edge. I can't do the things I used to do. You think that's the case, or is God the same yesterday, today, and forever? Persistence pays off. You know, if we know God, and we know that He is, and He is a rewarder of those that diligently seek Him, how come we can't kill the next Goliath? Why not? I have to summarize this very quickly, but I'll turn to one final scripture in Luke 18. Luke 18. Sometimes our giants fall for us right away. Other times we have to whittle away at them, keep on eroding their power, their influence over us. And an accumulation of small efforts repeated may be enough, like with all erosion, to bring down a major obstacle. In Luke 18, in verse 1, Jesus told his disciples a parable to show that they should always pray and not give up. He said, "In a certain town, there was a judge who neither feared God nor cared for what people thought. And there was a widow in that town who kept coming to him with the plea, 'Grant me justice against my adversary.' For some time he refused. But he finally said to himself, 'Even though I don't fear God or care what people think, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will see that she gets justice so that she will not keep continually coming back and attacking me.'" So it was a persistence, even with an ungodly person, that brought about a positive result. With all of us, being persistent makes a world of difference. Sometimes we have to do our part in order to provide what we can for ourselves, or take advantage of maybe assistance if it's available. But as it mentions over in 1 Timothy 5, you know, he talks about the need for the church to take care of other people. And then there are times, and Paul acknowledges this, and talking about the widowhood, that she is a widow indeed trusts in God. And the implication there is, look, when all else, all other resources are exhausted or whatever, God is very, very concerned. He will listen. He is interested in what's going on. And when the rubber meets the road, you just stare right up there in the heavens and you say, "God, I've done my part. You have to help me." And I expect that. And all of us can say that, just like this persistent widow in Luke 18, and expect something good to happen. So as I conclude here, let us consider the following things. We have to understand that maybe there are giants that we ourselves cannot slay. Things, problems that may haunt us. Issues of the past that we may need to sort out and bury or let go of. Or put on the shelf until God makes total resolution later on in the resurrection or whatever else. But understand that if we ourselves can't slay our giant, that our feeble selves plus God makes the difference, and the two together combined does fell the giant. Another concluding point. We have to know what God promises to us when we put Him first. We have to know. For example, seek you first the kingdom of God, and you will have food, clothing, and shelter. That may not mean a whole lot to some people, but for others, it is everything. And for all of us in the future, it will be important to remember. A third area. First was that we realize that with God's help, we can fight our giants. Secondly, that we, when we put Him first, we can expect His blessings. Thirdly, if we do our part, no matter how big or how small, it is our part. We have to play it. I don't think that you would do for your child what your child would be able to do for him or herself at an early age. If it was something, some chore, some responsibility. And we have our responsibility to learn what we can, do what we can, maybe to change, reinvent ourselves in the workplace, work hard, do our part. Take inventory of our skills, develop ourselves, change our attitudes, our habits, our ways of getting things done, whatever it takes, no matter how big our part or how small, we've got to do it. That's part of our responsibility and our partnership with God. And fourthly, humbly, demand results. Humbly. The Luke 18 example is paramount. The persistent widow was persistent, not because she thought she was so important or deserved it, but because it was a need. It was a need that needed to be filled, and this was the avenue by which it needed to be done. So if we do this, if we have our relationship with God and know that He wants us to slay our giants, if we learn to slay our giants, we will not only succeed, but we'll be among the great giant slayers who will inhabit the kingdom of God. You read about those in Luke and Hebrews 11 and elsewhere. It's a wonderful company to be a part of. And there's so much to gain and a lot to lose that how can we afford not to charge the giants of our lives?